According to data released by NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in their annual global climate report, it was the sixth hottest year on record for surface temperatures globally. But under the surface, ocean temperatures set new heat records in 2021.
Along with being home to an incredible number of diverse species, the ocean plays a pivotal role in regulating the Earth's heat and energy systems.
By absorbing our excess carbon and heat, the ocean acts as a buffer to the effects of climate change. On our episode, we speak with one of the authors of a new report that tracked warming in the world's oceans.
Join us now on the first episode of 2022 as we explore the ocean's energy system and the growing heat of the ocean.
Welcome back to Ocean Science Radio, the podcast that brings you the latest, greatest, and sometimes deepest stories in the ocean. I am shark scientist, aquanaut, and aspiring badass, Francis Faribault.
And I am climate and ocean science communications gunslinger, Andrew Kornblatt. For today's episode, we need to really start with some basics about the ocean and how it regulates heat and energy. It all starts with the sun. The sun is constantly bombarding the Earth with solar energy. The majority of that energy is absorbed on Earth, either by the atmosphere or by the ocean or by the land. The rest bounces back into space.
The ocean takes the energy it has absorbed from solar radiation and distributes heat and moisture around the globe, driving weather systems. The top layer of ocean water is constantly evaporating, increasing the temperature and humidity of the surrounding air to form rain and storms that are carried off by trade winds.
Ocean currents transport warm water and precipitation from the equator towards the poles and cold water from the poles back to the tropics in a continuous loop. It is through the absorption, distribution, and release of solar energy that the ocean regulates global climate, helping to counteract the uneven distribution of solar radiation reaching the Earth's surface.
As CO2 and other greenhouse gases from human activity accumulate in the atmosphere, this impacts the overall energy system of the Earth, as it causes more of that radiation to be caught on the planet. So where is that energy ending up? In 2019, it was discovered that the ocean had absorbed more than 90% of the heat gained by the planet between 1971 and 2010. Why is this important? Let's throw it over to our guest.
The ocean heat content is the best single indicator that the planet is warming.
That's Kevin Trenbooth. He is a distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and is currently located in Auckland, New Zealand, affiliated with the University of Auckland.
Kevin is part of a team that recently released a paper that took a comprehensive accounting of the ocean's heat across the globe.
The title of the paper is Another Record: Ocean Warming Continues Through 2021 Despite La Nina Conditions.
This paper involved a large collaboration trying to bring together the most up-to-date numbers on ocean temperatures.
Well, there are 23 authors involved in this. Out of those, there are two major groups that have assembled all of the oceanographic data. There's one core one, NOAA, in the United States. And so there's several authors related to that. But the main motivator behind the paper is the group led by Li-Jing Chang from the Institute of Atmospheric Physics in Beijing in China. And he leads their own analysis, which I think is certainly a better analysis than the one NOAA does by itself. But the paper actually presents results from both groups in there. And a new feature of the article this year, because we've done several of these articles before in previous years, is some regionalization. And so we've looked a bit harder at the North Pacific, the South Pacific, the Southern Oceans, the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, and so on.
But it isn't just a report on the current trends. There's a deeper, larger purpose here.
You know, all of us are very interested in determining what is going on with regard to global climate change. And the paper also has a segment in it that deals with so-called attribution. That is to say, what is the cause of the changes that we're seeing, and we are able to trace that back to the change in composition of the atmosphere, primarily the increasing greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and others. And we do that using a major climate model at my institution of NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research.
The technology that allows us to track the heat of the ocean has been deployed across the globe for almost 20 years now. Since about 2005, scientists have used these pressurized robotic sensors called Argo floats to track the top 2,000 meters of the ocean in some detail.
And there's about 3,009 of these floats. They're profiling floats. They're long, slender tubes, and they have a chamber inside that enables the chamber to be either filled with water, in which case the float sinks down to about two kilometers depth. And then if the chamber is pumped empty, the float shoots up to the surface, becomes very buoyant, and on the way it makes measurements of temperature and salinity. And then at the surface, there's an aerial on the top of this device, and it radios that information back to ground-based stations.
In addition, Kevin and his colleagues have been able to extend the overall oceanographic record back to at least 1958, giving a comprehensive data set to look at what is happening to ocean temperatures in the
When you look at the data, you find that the top 500 meters, there's very clear evidence of warming after about 1980. And if you look at the second layer, a 500 meter layer, from 500 to 1,000 meters depth, it's mainly after about 1988 that the warming kicks in. And then if you go to 1 kilometer depth to 1,500 meters depth, the main warming is after about 1998. And from 1,500 meters to 2,000 meters, the main warming is after about 2005. And so the warming is penetrating down, and the ocean can hold a tremendous amount of heat.
Imagine a pot of water on the stove. It takes quite a lot of energy to bring that half of a liter to a boil, even more if you add salt. Francis, do you want to tell us why that is?
So water has what's called a high specific heat capacity, which is basically a fancy way of saying you have to put a lot of energy into water before it heats up at all. Think about it this way. If you're going for a swim in the ocean, 70 degree water feels a lot colder than walking around in air in 70 degrees. That's because your body is losing heat to the water much faster. It's also the reason why water is one of the best coolants we have for machinery or computers or whatever systems might need coolant. For this same reason, the ocean has been absorbing lots of the excess energy in our atmosphere. So bringing that pot of water to a boil on the stove takes a lot of energy.
So now, if you really expand your imagination and think about the approximately 1.35 billion trillion liters of water in the oceans on Earth, and imagine that massive amount of volume increasing by just a degree or two, that is an exorbitant amount of energy that really makes me dizzy and kind of crazy trying to calculate exactly how much energy is involved here.
It's too many zeros. Good thing we have Kevin. So how much energy did the ocean actually take up, say in 2021?
There were about 14 more zeta joules than in 2020. And there's about 20 more zeta joules than were absorbed in 2019. Now, a zeta joule is one joule with 21 zeros after it. And so one zeta joule is 240 trillion trillion, I guess, calories. In other words, there's a 24 with 19 zeros after it, in terms of the calories that's being taken up by the ocean.
Just to help with the terms here, a joule is an international unit of energy that represents the energy needed to do a standard amount of work, like raising a 1 kilogram object by 1 meter. Another way to think of it is that 1 watt is equal to expending 1 joule per second. 1 kilowatt is 1,000 joules per second. So when we are talking about the ocean absorbing 14 zettajoules.
And so one can also put that in terms of something like 5 Hiroshima class nuclear bombs going off every second continuously throughout the year. That's the amount of energy that's going into the oceans. It's a huge amount of energy. And you know, another piece of context is that for the whole world, the amount of energy that humans use over a single year is about half a zettajoule. And so it's something like a factor of 28 times larger than all of the energy that humans use.
So every year the ocean is taking up that much energy.
Especially in La Nina years, which is what we've had over the past year. In 2016, it actually gave back about 10 zettajoules to the atmosphere and was responsible for the mini global warming that occurred there. So some of it can be saved up in the ocean and can come back to haunt us, if you like to think of it that way. But a lot of it just gets diffused into the ocean and produces this warming, and it's really not accessible other than in a general sense as a very small increment in temperatures. But that increment is quite important in terms of increasing the evaporation of moisture into the atmosphere.
Keep in mind that this is solar energy, and what normally happens is that this solar radiant energy is transformed into various other kinds of energy. This includes internal energy, which is related to temperature, but much of it is turned into latent energy, which is related to the amount of moisture that's in the atmosphere through the evaporation process. Then that moisture condenses out. Radiant energy also goes into kinetic energy, which is the energy associated with movement, and it goes into potential energy, which is relating to gravity and how high particles are held in the atmosphere. As the ocean and the atmosphere collect all this energy and is holding this potential energy, they expand.
And so all of this energy comes in, it gets moved around, it's what drives all of our weather systems, and ultimately it gets radiated back to space. And in an equilibrium climate, the amount of energy that goes back to space as infrared radiation balances the incoming radiation. And what is happening now is that there's an energy imbalance. And that energy imbalance is what is producing global warming, or it's really better to think of it as global heating, because it really affects all of these different forms of energy. About 93% of the energy from the energy imbalance is going into the oceans. And about half of the rest of it goes into melting ice, melting glaciers in Greenland and so on. The other half of the rest of it goes mostly into warming up the land. And so you can see the penetration of heat into land, and it ends up melting permafrost, for instance. There's a very tiny bit, less than 1%, that goes into heating the atmosphere. The atmosphere doesn't have a very much heat capacity in that regard. But, you know, overall it is indeed warming, but there's a lot of variability in the atmosphere also from year to year, simply because of weather and clouds and things like that.
When we look at greenhouse gases, the most recent studies see that through the growth of greenery and plants, terrestrial collection takes up about 25% of CO2, and the ocean takes up about 27%. The remainder stays in the atmosphere, collecting more and more heat. While the ocean is acting as a buffer for climate change impact, it can't keep absorbing heat and CO2 at the same rate every year. As the ocean warms, it cannot absorb as much carbon dioxide.
It's like putting a pot of water on the stove. If you start to warm it up, you'll see bubbles coming out of it. And the water can no longer hold as much of the dissolved air, or carbon dioxide for that matter. And it's a similar thing with a pop bottle. When you take the cap off the bottle, the gas starts to come out because there's no longer any pressure holding it down. And so as the ocean warms, its capacity for taking up carbon dioxide gradually decreases, which is worrying. It's probably true with regard to the ocean heat. I mean, the ocean is very deep and eventually can take up a huge amount of heat. but it doesn't mix well.
The ocean is stratified into multiple layers, and a lot of heat in the ocean tends to sit on top because the ocean is a stable configuration. Warm water on top, cold water on bottom. It has been shown that global warming is actually increasing the stratification of the ocean, making it even more stable in the separation of layers, which means there's not much oxygen or carbon dioxide or heat, for that matter, diffusing to the depths of the ocean as one might expect. Scientists aren't really sure how much energy the ocean really can collect, but the general consensus is that there is an upper limit, which feels like something we should be paying attention to.
As the ocean takes up and distributes its heat across the globe, there are times when the pressure valve gets opened and the energy gets released in the form of a hotspot.
One form of marine heat wave or a hotspot is that if it's in the tropics, it can fuel hurricanes. And we've certainly been able to document examples of that. And so the hurricanes become more intense, longer lasting, bigger, and they have tremendous amounts of rainfall associated with them. And so there's major flooding associated with them. And so this affects all of the small island states in the tropics in the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, for instance. And Hurricane Ida produced tremendous amounts of rain all the way from the Gulf of Mexico up to almost to the Canadian border and certainly in the New York area. And so very profound influences. And then
Cyclone Ray
caused over 400 deaths in the Philippines in association with that particular storm. And so there's big impacts of these. The hurricane itself takes heat out of the ocean and is apt to wipe out the hotspot, at least for a little while. And so you never find hurricanes following in one another's track. They all have amazingly different tracks, and it's partly because of the fact that the hurricanes influence the ocean heat content by mixing it up and by taking heat out.
As the ocean takes up more energy and heat, we will see more of the effects through the expansion of the ocean causing sea levels to rise, through the melting of sea ice, increased number and severity of storms as that energy needs to release, and even possibly the disruption of currents that help regulate the ocean.
All right, so back to the paper. How does Kevin hope that this paper will be used? What impact does he hope it will have?
So I certainly hope that it gets used primarily to indicate that we should not sit back and say, oh, it's the global mean surface temperature hasn't gone up and therefore we don't have to worry. We do have to worry. In fact, we have to worry as much as before. Carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere keep going up in spite of the pandemic. And the ocean heat content keeps going up. Global warming, if you like, is alive and well, unfortunately, and it has substantial consequences, and we've seen many of those consequences over the past year. Now, our paper does not include the impacts so much, although we do talk a bit about some of the marine heat waves that I mentioned before, that there are hot spots that develop around the world more and more on top of the overall warming of the ocean. And they're relating to weather patterns and things like the El Nino phenomenon. And those hot spots have profound effects on the marine life from the tiny phytoplankton, the zooplankton, which are often food for fish. So it affects fish, it affects birds. It affects marine mammals like otters and seals and whales, and has profound effects on all of the marine life systems that exist. In terms of what one does about the overall problem, this provides the analysis of the observations and the data, the hard information that provides a basis for taking actions. You know, what actions one takes depends often on value systems, it depends on different countries. And we saw the debate that occurred in COP26 in Glasgow late last year, where there is a certain amount of confusion. There is one part of that debate which is focused on, can we slow down or stop this problem? And that means One of the things which is often talked about is, can we get to net zero by, say, 2050? Net zero means no more increases in greenhouse gases. It doesn't necessarily mean no more emissions, as long as it's compensated for by taking carbon dioxide out of the system. And also methane was a key discussion point. But there's also a large element of the Glasgow meeting, which is focused on, you know, what can we do about this, given that it's already happening and it's having major impacts? How do we build resilience? How do we prepare for this? How do we adapt to climate change? And there are many small island states, for instance, that have really had very little to do with causing the problem, but they're victims, if you like to think of it that way, of rising sea level and stronger storms that cause major problems for them, and they're looking for help and not getting anything like enough. And so it's a different kind of problem in a way. These two things are obviously coupled to one another, but I think they actually also get in the way of each other in some ways.
One other point that Kevin has made in our conversations was that there is a continued need for observing. There is a non-trivial cost associated with not only deploying the Argo floats that we mentioned earlier, but with battery replacement and maintenance for them. Each float has a lifetime of about 5 years before the battery runs down and they have to be replaced.
The work that each contributing agency and scientists did to help further the understanding of the ocean and our impact on it takes time and money, and all of us who care about our planet need to make sure that our elected officials know that and know that it is important.
Agencies across the world are going to continue to monitor the situation, and we will continue to bring you updates as they happen.
And hopefully we will continue to bring you cute, cuddly creatures and, fingers crossed, some good news.
Thanks to our guest, Kevin, and of course, thanks to you, our listeners.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this podcast with your colleagues and friends. We'll see you all next time on another episode of
Ocean Science Radio. Each float has a lifetime of about 5 years before the battery runs down and they have to be replaced.
The work that each Did you hear that?
Is that its scream?
No, that was my tiny dog whining. She's very vocal.